Well, with the Parsha of Va'era, the Geula, redemption of the Jewish people, begins in earnest. And as we know, the beginning of Parshas Va'era has with it the famous, what are known as Arba Lashonos of Geula, the four expressions of redemption. And that is in Perek Zion, Pasuk Vav and Zion. The Pesukim are well known, but let us read them to enter into this discussion. So Hashem says, Lachen emor levnei Yisrael, ani Hashem, say to bnei Yisrael, I am Hashem, v'hotzeisi eschem mitachas sivlos Mitzrayim, I'll take you out from the burdens of Mitzrayim, v'yitzalti eschem me'avodosam, I'll save you from their work, v'go'alti eschem b'zro netuyo v'shvatim gedolim, I will redeem you with outstretched arm, great judgments, v'lokachti eschem li la'am, and I will take you to me as a people. These are the well-known Arba Lashonos of Geula. As we know, these four expressions of redemption will then find mitzvah expression in the four cups on Seder night. So says the Yerushalmi in Maseches Pesachim, in the beginning of the 10th Perek. It is not the only explanation there, but it's probably the most well-known explanation of all. For the Arba Kosos, they correspond to Votzesi, Vitzalti, Vigoalti, Vilakarti. And the question that we'd like to explore is, why is this? How do these four expressions translate into these Arba Kosos? And moreover, the four cups on Seder night come at very specific points in the Seder. It's not just a question of one, two, three, four. The first cup, as we know, is Kiddush, that's Kadesh. The second cup is at the end of Magid. The third cup is after benching, and the fourth cup is after Hallel, which means that to get an even more itemized appreciation of the connection between the four expressions and the four cups, we need to see how each one lands in a cup at that particular point in the Seder. And many Mefarshim discussed this. We have discussed it in the past. Mirtz Hashem, we will yet discuss it in the future. But this evening, the one who is guiding us is the Meshech Chochma. And this is in his opening discussion in Parshas Va'era. And the first thing that the Meshech Chochma emphasizes, which everyone does in order to really appreciate what is happening here, is that the four expressions of redemption are not four ways of saying the same thing. And sometimes that might be a misleading use of the term expression, Arba Lashonos of Geula, because four expressions of something can sometimes basically be, it's the same thing and there's just four ways to describe it. Actually, the Yerushalmi doesn't call them four expressions of redemption, it calls them four redemptions. Arba Geulos, which emphasizes that we're dealing with either four different stages of redemption or four different elements of redemption. But they really are four distinct areas. And what are these areas? So Meshech Chochma, in his way, explains as follows. V'hotzeisi, the first thing is Hashem takes us out from the impure influences of Mitzrayim. That's the spiritual toll that had been taken, again, at least behaviorally, as we discussed last week. He references a mechilta, where when Hashem in Sefer Devarim refers to us leaving Mitzrayim, or Moshe in Hashem's name, as lakachas lo goy mikerev goy, to take one nation from another nation, says the mechilta, it's like a fetus was taken from the womb. That when the Jewish people are taken from Egypt, it's like the child is delivered from the womb. And the analogy of the fetus to the womb is very significant, because when the fetus is in the womb, it is nourished and sustained by everything that nourishes and sustains the mother. It's very much affected. And it's nutrients and influences. And this is the Jewish people in Egypt, they're in the womb. And there are certain qualities and practices that will filter down into them and affect them. That has to go. They need to be removed from that. And that is Vehutseisi. That's the first thing says Meshech Chochmah, from negative spiritual influences. The second expression, or the second term, Vehitzalti, I will save you, Hatzalah, says Meshech Chochmah, is always a person who's saved from, that's a life and death situation. And indeed, things had gotten so dire in Egypt that there were threats to life. This was not just quote-unquote servitude, people's lives were in the balance, whether it's Kol HaBen HaYilod, HaYor Tashlichuhu, and it was a life-threatening situation, a matter of survival. That's Vehitzalti, that's Hatzalah. Number three, Vigo'alti, redemption addresses the issue of slavery itself. And Geula is the opposite of Avdus, and therefore from the state of slavery to be removed from that, that's Geula. And what about Velokachti? The first three are in a sense negative in that they are removing something bad, bad spiritual influence, threat to life, state of slavery, removing all of that, which brings the Jewish people, in a sense, to the lack of all those things. But where does it take them to? That's Velokachti. Velokachti eschem li la'am. And indeed, we note that the earlier expressions are generally being saved and taken out from things. Velokachti is being taken to, towards Hashem, to become a nation with everything that entails, with sovereignty and national order, with Hashem as their king. And that's Velokachti, stage four, aspect four. So we've taken a comprehensive look at the four elements of redemption, as the Meshech Chochmah describes them, explains them. But the most important thing to realize before we, or to consider before we proceed, is that these two sets of four, that is to say, four terms of redemption, four cups, are actually both based on a prior set of four. There is a third set of four, which really comes before all of this, which will guide us in this regard. And that is, Chazal tell us that there were four outstanding merits on account of which the Jewish people deserved to be redeemed from Mitzrayim. So says the Michilta. Some of them are well known. Actually, there are different lists in different Midrashim, but the Michilta itself says that the four are as follows. Number one, that the Jewish people did not descend into physical immorality, into arayos, which was no mean achievement given the fact that they were in a place where the climate was so rife with that type of immorality, but they did not let themselves go in that respect. Secondly, says the Michilta, they didn't speak Lashon Hara one against the other. This, of course, is famously contrasted with the one case of yes of Lashon Hara, of Dasan and Aviram. But on the whole, the Jewish people didn't speak Lashon Hara, and that's also an important achievement. Because very often, if a nation is being oppressed or under difficult circumstances, individuals might feel that they can better their circumstance by somehow informing on others and place themselves in a situation of advantage. The Jewish people did not do that. They did not speak ill of each other. The third thing, says the Michilta, is that they did not change their names. They retained Hebrew names. Loshinu es Shemam, well known. And the fourth is Loshinu es Lashonam. They didn't change their language among themselves. They spoke Hebrew. They didn't speak Egyptian. There's another idea of Loshinu es Malbusham. They didn't change their clothes. That's not on the Mechilta's list. Maybe it could be on other lists. But either way. So again, to summarize, the four significant merits, redemption-worthy merits of the Jewish people, number one, they were not involved in arayos, physical immorality. Number two, they didn't speak Lashon Hara, one against the other. Number three, they didn't change their names. And number four, they didn't change their language from Hebrew to anything else. Says Meshech Chochma, it's these four merits that begat and enabled the four aspects of redemption, which will then find expression in the four cups on Seder night. How so? Let us go and see them one by one. We'll follow the order of the cups, which was probably the easiest way. The first cup is Kiddush, is Kaddish. And in Kiddush, especially on Yom Tov, we note that we speak as much about Hashem sanctifying the Jewish people as he does about as we do about him sanctifying the Yom Tov. On Shabbos, we say that Hashem is Mekadesh HaShabbos, and we are stating that, and witnessing that, and affirming that. But when it comes to Yom Tov, we don't say that Hashem is Mekadesh the Yom Tov, we say he is Mekadesh Yisrael Vahazmanim. Yisrael are mentioned first, and not only are they mentioned first, but it's actually Yisrael who are Mekadesh the Yom Tov. As the Gemara says in the seventh parak of Brachos, that's the flow. Hashem is Mekadesh the Jewish people, and the Jewish people, Yisrael are Mekadesh the Zmanim. Which means the first cup celebrates and marks and recognizes the Kedusha of the Jewish people. Where does that Kedusha come from? This, says Meshech Chochma, is in response to the efforts of the Jewish people not to allow themselves to descend into arayos, to physical immorality, which is always considered to be the antithesis of Kedusha. As Rashi says in Parshas Kedoshim, where the Torah itself tells us, Kedoshim Tihiyu, as Rashi, whenever you find distancing from arayos, that's where you'll find Kedusha, and therefore in recognition of the Jewish people, keeping themselves together in that very significant area, they received Kedusha. And that's reflected at the cup of Kaddish, and this responds to the term of Geula called Vahotseisi, which, as Meshech Chochma explained, is being removed from the negative spiritual influences of Egypt. And therefore, to summarize, cup number one is Kaddish, Kedusha. It's about Kedushas Yisrael, which corresponds to Vahotseisi, the first of the terms, and is in the merit of not the Jewish people protecting themselves from arayos. The second cup accompanies Magid, right? We say the Haggadah, and then we make the bracha at the conclusion of Magid. At the conclusion of Magid is the beginning of Hallel. The first two paragraphs of Hallel are at the end of Magid, and in fact, they're part of Magid. As we note closer to Pesach, they're not even called Hallel. Even in that poem of Kaddish Urchatz, Karpes Yachatz, Magid covers everything. We don't say Hallel part one and then later Hallel part two. It's all Magid. And the beginning of Hallel is about the beginning of the Jewish people, but say Yisrael Mimitzrayim, and certainly the story of the of our roots. One of the trademarks, or characteristics, symptoms of slavery that for us it's hard to relate to, but a slave has no sense of self-worth. Certainly no notion that he could ever leave that situation, certainly back in the day. Nowadays, slavery, perhaps, we've seen so many times when slavery is overturned, but at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, this had never happened. Some say it's because of Yetzias Mitzrayim. This enabled other revolutions and emancipations to exist. But at the time, a slave has no notion that he will ever be free. And there's no thoughts of anything beyond life as a slave. That's as far as his vision goes. And Geula, as we said, the term Vigo'alti, is a release from slavery. But what is this in recognition of? Says Meshech Chochma, this is the contribution of Loshinu Eschamam. They didn't change their names. Because the names that the Jewish people had from way back when is from before they were slaves. To keep those names going is to trace themselves back to their ancestors who were yet free. And why are they doing that? Because they're preserving a vision that once again they could be free. Slavery, it does not define them. If it did, they should say goodbye to all of those names from a different era which will never again return. But the notion is that it will return. And that was, again, a great merit for the Jewish people. So to summarize cup number two, It's at the end of Maggid, which is at the beginnings of the Jewish people going back to their roots. Loshinu es shemam preserves a sense of their roots, and that resulted in Vigla'alti, indeed, of them breaking out of that ultimately temporary state, which is called slavery. The third cup accompanies Birchas Hamazon. And Birchas Hamazon, of course, is about thanking Hashem for providing us for our material sustenance. Says Meshech Chochma, this corresponds to the expression of Vihitzalti, I will save you, which, as we said, is saving the Jewish people from those who are looking to destroy them. And here, Meshech Chochma says a very profound thing. When will Hashem help the Jewish people if the people are pursuing them to destroy them? When the Jewish people are not pursuing each other to destroy each other. If that happens, they're asking for trouble. But as long as the Jewish people are looking out for each other and they're not pursuing each other, that bodes well for Hashem then to save them from others who are pursuing them and seeking their demise. And this corresponds to Lo Dibru Lashon Hara. They didn't speak Lashon Hara, one against the other. It would be an easy thing, as we said, for one slave to advance his position on the cheshbon of the other, by pursuing them, by slandering them, by reporting them, or whatever it is, as we know. But they didn't do that. And that outstanding merit of them distancing themselves from any pursuit one of the other allowed Hashem to, or them to be worthy of Hashem saving them from Mitzrayim, who are pursuing them to seek their demise. And that is Vihitzalti, as we said. Vihitzalti is the saving of the lives of the Jewish people. What does this have to do with benching? What does Lashon Hara have to do with benching? Says Meshech Chochma, when do people pursue each other? When they lose sight of the fact that everything they need for their well-being is provided for them by Hashem. As soon as they lose sight of that, and they enter im ein ani li mi li mode, it's every man for themselves, I've got to look out for number one, and that if that involves turning in number two, then it's worth it. And this echoes a theme that we've mentioned in recent months, once or twice, from the Vilna Gaon. Namely, that at root level, sinas chinam, hatred one of the other, which is basically Lashon Hara waiting to happen, hatred one of the other is a symptom of lack of bitachon. And that's why the generation of the second Churban, whose reverberations we still feel, and in whose consequences we're still in exile, two things are said about them. Number one, famously, sinas chinam, and number two, they didn't have bitachon. And the Vilna Gaon is really pre-stating what Meshech Chochma echoes, that if you have bitachon, so then Hashem will look after you, so then there's room for the other person. You don't need to step on them or try and destroy them or bring them down. And therefore, putting this together, says Meshech Chochma, the third cup, at the time of Birchas Hamazon, where we thank and recognize Hashem as the source of our material well-being, that's what allows people to desist from speaking Lashon Hara one against the other. And all this corresponds, as we said, to the cup of Vihitzalti. Now, this brings us to the fourth and final cup, and that's about Hallel. And Hallel is about the Jewish people pursuing their destiny as Hashem's people. It's an exaltation of the Jewish people as Hashem's people. And that, of course, corresponds to the expression of Velokachti. And what reflects the basic sense that the Jewish people are a people distinct with their own destiny and identity is keeping their own language, Loshinu es Lashona. In fact, the individual that is mentioned by name as really bearing the flag here for this idea is Yosef. Yosef famously continues to speak Lashon HaKodesh, as we always discuss in Parshas Vayigash. He maintains the language of his people, and he is the one that passes on the message of Geula to the people. He's the one that says, at the end of Chumash Bereishis, Ve'elokim pakod yifkod eschem, this is not permanent. Hashem will recall you, and he'll bring you out. Ve'elo eschem in the aretz hazos, Asher nishba l'Avraham, l'Yitzchak, Uliyakov. And therefore, corresponding to Velokachti, which is about taking the Jewish people to Hashem as a people, that is celebrated at the time that we say Hallel, which is a celebration of the Jewish people as Hashem's people, all of which significantly can be traced back to Loshinu es Loshonam. So this is the explanation of the Meshech Chochmah. It's a real tour de force. And if we may summarize with the four cups, each one, the aspect that it represents, the first cup represents sanctity, Kadesh. The second cup represents history, our roots. The third cup represents harmony, not speaking Lashon Hara one against the other. And the fourth cup is the cup of destiny of the Jewish people as Hashem's people. And Meshech Chochmah concludes by just mentioning two points. Firstly, that all of this surrounds wine, because wine represents the distinction of the Jewish people, lavstam yedom, they're circumspect in terms of who they drink and whose wine they would use, and therefore it really is an entity that reflects the uniqueness of the Jewish people, says Meshech Chochmah. If preserving our uniqueness was what enabled us to merit being redeemed from Mitzrayim, it should certainly augur well for our redemption in the future, the more we establish and develop our distinction in the positive, most positive sense of the word, the more we can look forward to that geula, which should come b'mehera b'yameinu. So these are truly great remarks from Meshech Chochmah, classic exposition on the Arba Kosos. Well, moving a little further into the Parsha, and the Parsha, of course, is devoted in the main to the Makos. The first seven of the ten will come in Va'era, the last three in Parshas Bo. And as a prelude to this, in Perik Zayin Pasuk Aleph, we find. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe. Hashem says to Moshe, Re'eh, see, Nisaticha Elohim lefaro. I have made you into, I have set you up or appointed you as an Elohim to Pharaoh, and Aaron, achicha yenevi'echa. Aaron will be your nevi'echa, Rashi says your spokesperson. What is the meaning of Moshe being appointed as Elohim lefaro? Whatever it means, the most important thing to do is not to read this word as Elohim, because one only uses the pronunciation of Elohim when we're talking about Hashem. Elohim can refer to a person. A judge is called Elohim in Parshas Mishpatim. Angels are called Elohim. And it's important to say Elohim to distinguish them from Hashem, who is Elohim. So one shouldn't, in the interest of Frumkeit, say something which is terribly objectionable and ruinous. So Moshe is called Elohim lefaro. And what does it mean? Rashi explains. Shofate. So Rashi associates the Elohim that Moshe is now, like Elohim in Parshas Mishpatim, a judge, but a judge in what respect? Veroda, and a punisher. Liradoso b'makos v'yisur, to punish Paro with plagues and suffering. So it's the punitive aspect of judgment that is being entrusted and handed over to Moshe. There are other explanations of what it means that Moshe is Elohim lefaro, which we've discussed in the past, but for now we pursue Rashi's path, which is Moshe is being set up as a punisher for Paro. What is the significance of this appointment of Moshe as Elohim lefaro? So this matter is discussed by Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, the Briska Rav, and he explains as follows. Here, we are being alerted to the fact that we need to approach and appreciate the Makos correctly. We may understand, and as we'll see, the Parsha will unfold, and the Makos are coming one after the other, progressively and systematically. And what is the goal of those Makos? One might have thought the goal of the Makos is to try and effect the release of the Jewish people. And systematically, they get worse and worse until at the end, Paro cannot withstand it anymore. But says the Brisker Rav, Rav Elva Soloveitchik, that's not what the makos are for. The makos are not there in order to ensure that Paro will set the Jewish people free. The makos are there in order to punish Paro for past wrongdoings, specifically with regards to the Jewish people. And this really is backed up by the Medrash, which shows the midah keneged midah of every makah, which whatever it will be, they tormented the Jewish people like this, and therefore they got this makah, and they oppressed them in the following way, and therefore they got that makah. In other words, this is not geared exclusively or even primarily towards securing the release of the Jewish people. It is significantly in order to punish the Egyptians. It's not about Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's about Golas Mitzrayim. And this is in fulfillment of that which was foretold to Avram Avinu in the Bris Ben Abisarim, in Parshas Lech Lecha, Parshas Tesvav, where Hashem not only said, Vavod ger yezaracha, vavod nevi'inu son, they'll be enslaved and they'll be persecuted, but he also says, Vegam es hagoy asher yavodu don anochi, the nation that they will serve, don anochi, I will judge them and punish them, Rashi says there, with eser makos. So the aspect of don anochi within the covenant between the pieces, the Bris Ben Abisarim, that's what fulfilled through the eser makos. They're being judged for past offenses. This is not with an eye on the future to secure Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's with an eye on the past to redress and give a retribution for their crimes against the Jewish people. And this idea, says Rav Elva Soloveitchik, is expressed explicitly in the Mishnah. The Mishnah in Maseches Edios states that the term of judgment for Rishoyim is 12 months. That has ramifications for Kaddish, we always do less. But the idea that the term for Mishpat, for punishment, is 12 months, heavenly punishment, is learned from Mitzrayim. Shekein ata motzi b'Mitzrayim, because thus you find in Mitzrayim, which explicitly highlights what's going on in Mitzrayim with the Makos as punishment for the Mitzrayim, and from which we learn that that's how Mishpat goes. We've mentioned on other occasions that one needs to look very carefully to see exactly how we call them the year of the plagues, the year of the Makos, how exactly we're to understand that they lasted for a year. What we see, for example, from Rashi is that, well, the Torah itself says that there were 7 days after the plague of blood. That's all the Torah says, from which we then understand that the plague of blood was 7 days, which then becomes extrapolated to indicate that every month had a plague for 7 days and then 3 weeks of respite. That's how Rashi explains, for example. Now, if that's the case, there's 10 plagues, so then it would be 10 months, and in fact, it would be even less than 10 months, because the final plague of Makas Bechoros took an instant, or actually less, which means that it would be 9 months, and 9 months is not 12 months. So how is it that the 10 plagues would be spread out over 12 months? That needs to be understood. Ramban also famously notes that even the plague of Barad, which is the final plague in Parshas Va'era, the plague of hail, which is number 7, seems to have taken place in the springtime, quite close to Pesach, because the Pasuk describes which crops were affected, which weren't affected, depending on the season, the harvest season. That's very close to Pesach, you know, around Purim time. And that's Makkah number 7, a month before Pesach. So all of these discussions and points need to be thrashed out in a separate deliberations. But however it's understood, all of the details, the resulting conclusion is that we look at the punishment of the Egyptians as being for 12 months, and that is now representative of punishment for all Rishoyim. That tells you very clearly, says the Brisker Rav, this is punishment for past offenses. And it is for this reason, says Avelvel, that Hashem appoints Moshe as Elohim Lepharo in this pasuk, Perek Zayin, pasuk Aleph, as if to say, if this is a significant dynamic within what's going to happen this year, the makas are there, l'shem punishment, Moshe needs to be appointed as the punisher, as the one to oversee that element of the proceedings, so to speak. I think it's correct to note that this approach of Rebbe Velvel Soloveitchik seems in line with the Rambam. Not surprisingly, if the Soloveitchiks are with the Rambam, but the Rambam states that the hardening of Paro's heart took place even before any of the Makos started. In other words, the hardening of Paro's heart is as a result of past crimes, for which the punishment is that he'll be punished and his heart will be hardened so that he will not be able to avoid the punishment. And that fits in very well, because Paro is already deserving of all 10 plagues before any of them have begun. And that's all punishment. Thus far, with regard to the Makos, they're all a fulfillment of Don Anochi. Again, to be clear, to state it as clearly as we can, Biskarov is explaining that this is not about securing the release of the Jewish people, it's about punishing Paro and the Egyptians for what they did to the Jewish people. However, all of this is holds true with reference to the first 9 plagues. But we need to appreciate that in this regard, the 10th Makkah, Makkas Becheros, the firstborn, it comes into its own. It's not like any of the others. Meaning, on the one hand, of course, it's exactly like the others. It's further punishment. On the one hand, it's number 10 on the list of 10. And it's the worst. It's the final stage of punishment, at least in Egypt. So it is like the other 9 on the one hand. But there's another aspect to it, which none of the first 9 share. And that is, Makkas Becheros really is the prelude. It really is the trigger for releasing the Jewish people from Mitzrayim. And it's very interesting to note in this regard, and as we may yet discuss a little bit later on, some of the Makos have warnings before them, some of them don't, and Makkas Becheros does, but it's not like any of the other warnings. If we consider any of the plagues where there's a warning, the warnings there are in the nature of an ultimatum. As if to say, Hashem says, I'm telling you to set my people free, and if you don't do that, the following will happen. And the idea is that, hopefully, again, leaving aside issues of the hardening of Paro's heart, what would happen is that hearing that these things will happen, Paro will relent. In other words, the foretelling is with a view to saying, this will happen if you don't let them go. And very often it was in the midst of these plagues, when things were getting more and more unbearable, the Paro relented until the plague abated and then he retracted. But that's the dynamic with the warnings. They really are ultimatums issued. But when it comes to Makkas Becheros, what Moshe says to Paro is nothing like anything else. He doesn't say to Paro, I'm telling you again to let the Jewish people go, and if you don't, I'm going to smite the firstborn. Moshe doesn't say that the firstborn will be smitten if Paro doesn't let the Jewish people go. He just says they're going to be smitten. That will definitely happen. And with regards to letting the Jewish people go, Moshe does talk about that as something that will also definitely happen. These are no longer terms. These are no longer warnings. These are very simply foretellings. Makkas Becheros will happen, and when it happens, you will let the Jewish people go. In Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Dalet, just to see, it's important to notice this, because we might perhaps group it together a little bit too easily with the other Makkos, that there were predictions beforehand. This is nothing like anything that was said beforehand. Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Dalet. Vayomer Moshe, Komar Hashem, Kachatzos Halayla Ani Yoseh B'Tzeach Mitzrayim. That's it. You should know. I'm telling you, but it's going to happen, and it's not Nothing. There's nothing you can do about it. Umeish kobuchor be'eretz Mitzrayim. And as a result of that, meaning not due to the pressure of that they won't be able to withstand the pressure of the plague will be over before they know it. And it will be finished. And even when it's finished, that's when they'll let the Jewish people go. Not for fear of further retribution, it will just be the end. They'll bow down to me, they'll say, go, and then we'll go. All of this is just because what we're discussing now is actual Yetzias Mitzrayim. And therefore, once again, when it comes to Makas Bechoros, on the one hand, of course, it partakes of the punitive nature of the first nine, but it also is an entity and has a dynamic all to its own. It is the beginning of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And it's very interesting to follow this through and to note that very often when we talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim, we don't necessarily mention all the plagues, but we will always mention Makas Bechoros. So make up your mind. You're going to talk about the Makas or no? Because if you are, mention all 10. And if not, then just start with Yetzias Mitzrayim. But the answer is, we're not talking about the Makas here. We're talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim, but Yetzias Mitzrayim begins with Makas Bechoros. And therefore, for example, in the bracha after Kriyat Shema in the morning, Mitzrayim Galtanu, we're talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim, Kol Bechoreim Haragta, Ubechorcha Ga'alta. And then, of all the 10, if we're talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim, you can't talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim fully, about them leaving, without the instigation of Makas Bechoros. And it's interesting that we actually say that we left even before we talk about Makas Bechoros. Mi Mitzrayim Ga'altanu. Even with chronologically, of course, Makas Bechoros happened, but just to emphasize that we're already within the realms of Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's in that capacity, within that frame and setting that we're mentioning Makas Bechoros. And the same is true in the evening, in the bracha after Kriyat Shema, Emes ve'emuna, hamakeh be'evroso, kol bechorim Mitzrayim, Hashem smote with his wrath, all the bechorim of Mitzrayim, vayotzeis am Yisrael, mitochon lecheirus olam. Once again, there is no mention of any of the other makos, just number 10, as a prelude to Yetzias Mitzrayim, Vayotzeis Am Yisrael. So that's in the Tefillah. But the same is true in Tanakh. In Sefer Tehillim, in Kuf Lamed Vav, the Kila Olam Chastos, that we say on Shabbos morning, so we say, Lemakim Mitzrayim Bivchareihim. And then Vayotzeis Am Yisrael Mitochon Lecheirus Olam. Once again, only a mention of Makas Bechoros and straight away segueing into Yetzias Mitzrayim, because Makas Bechoros is mentioned as the portal for Yetzias Mitzrayim. And the matter is most highlighted, poignantly, on Seder night in Dayenu. Now Dayenu is later, but part of the Agada. And what do we say in Dayenu? We go through all the Ilus, Ilu to this. So there are many distinct stages. But we say, Ilu Oso Behem Shvatim, had Hashem performed judgments against them, otherwise known as the Makos, Ilu Oso Behem Shvatim, Dayenu. Later on we say, Ilu Horeges Becharehem. So we've made reference to the Shvatim, judgments, which is the Makos. And still we make specific reference to Makas Becharehem. Which all the more highlights and underscores the fact that Makas Bechoros has more to it than the judgment nature of the other nine. And interestingly, if we look there in Dayenu, not only is it mentioned separately, but there's something in between. It's almost like a chatzitza between the first nine, Ilu Osobem Shvatim, then what do we say? Velo Osobelohehem. But you didn't mete out justice against their deities. So not only is the Shvatim of the first nine separated from, or distinct from number 10, but there's something in between. Because that's all the punishment stage. The punishments of the for them, and for Elohim, and for all their deities, and destroying their statues. And then we move on to Yetzias Mitzrayim, which starts as is so often the case in those other settings, as we've seen with Makas Bechoros. So if I can borrow the expression, but where more appropriate, and when discussing Brisker Torah, Makas Bechoros has Tzvei Dinim. It has two elements going on within it. On the one hand, it has the punishment element, like the first 10, but on the other hand, it is the Yetzias Mitzrayim element as well. So this is the classic observation and discussion of Rebbe Avraham Soloveitchik with regards to the Eser Makos, which of course is such a major theme throughout Parshas Va'era. Further on the topic of the punishment of the Egyptians, which again is the mainstay of our Parsha, there is a question that Rishonim ask. And the question begins by referring back to, as we mentioned before, that the subjugation and enslavement and persecution of the Jewish people has already been foretold by Avram, to Avram, by Hashem. And Hashem says, this is what will happen, this will happen and this will happen. Which leads some Rishonim to ask a question, why would the Egyptians be punished if they're basically carrying out Hashem's will? Hashem wants this to happen, as is evidenced by the fact that he said it will happen. So isn't that Hashem's will? Isn't doing Hashem's will a good thing? It might not be pleasant for the Jewish people, but Hashem wants it to happen for whatever reason, for their benefit ultimately, and therefore whoever is the instrument of persecution should be applauded, perhaps even rewarded. He's done a mitzvah. We should note, this question is distinct from the famous question raised by the Rambam, which is more an issue of free will. Rambam says, if it's already been foretold that they'll be persecuted, how can the nation that persecutes them be punished? How could they do otherwise? Hashem has already said it will happen. That's a question of predetermination and so on. But this is a separate question. This is, even if they do have free will, they're using their free will for a good enterprise, fulfilling the mitzvah of Ger Yazarecha Be'eretz Lo'lahem, Lavod Ve'inu Ozem. And this question is discussed at length by the Ramban. The Ramban in Parshas Lech Lecha, and he gives two classic answers to this question. The first, says Ramban, which is a chiddush because he really concedes much of the premise of the question. Namely, says Ramban, indeed it is so. Had they fulfilled exactly what Hashem had in mind of persecuting the Jewish people, then they would have done nothing wrong, and perhaps even done something right. The problem is, the Egyptians by far exceeded any mandate of persecuting the Jewish people, because they started to kill them and throw their babies into the Nile, and that's already not enslavement. I mean, that's a wholesale murder. And because they'd exceeded the mandate that was allotted to them, and this is without going into the question of, did the Egyptians know that this is God's plan and so on? How much information do they have about that? Regardless, they for sure exceeded it. And therefore, for anything that they've done in excess of what God, so to speak, had in mind, for that they need to be completely punished. He cites in this regard a pasuk in the Novi, in Sefer Zechariah, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tes Vav, where Hashem says, "Veketzef gadol ani kotzef, I will have great wrath against the goyim, hashananim, those complacent goyim, asher ani kafatzti ma'at, katzafti ma'at, I was angry a little bit against the Jewish people, vehema ozru lera'a, and they helped a little bit too much, way more than I had in mind. If Hashem sets a nation up as an instrument of retribution for the Jewish people, but that nation then goes me'alu me'aver, and you have Hashem's will is to do one thing, but the nation goes mahadrin, and maybe even mahadrin mina mahadrin, in their persecutions, for that they will be punished. So for, again, to be clear, the Ramban is really saying, had they stayed within the mandate and parameters of what the Brisbane Abbasar was talking about, they would not have been punished, which is a great chiddush. But they went way beyond that. And says Ramban, that is why Hashem says to Avram, V'gam es hagoy ashiavodu don anochi, I will judge them. We translate that very rapidly into the practical punishments. But Hashem didn't say, I will punish them. He said, I will judge them, because they'll need to be judged. A judgment will need to occur. Have they stayed within, or have they expanded without? And indeed, they did expand without, and for that reason, they were deserving of punishment. The second idea, says Ramban, which is a somewhat more, say, ruchnius idea, a matter of intent. Namely, Ramban in the second approach says, perhaps a nation could claim that they're doing Hashem's work, but they need to intend that that's what they're doing, as opposed to furthering their own agenda and not recognizing that Hashem has this in store for the Jewish people at all. As we say, by the way, in Seder night, Shefocha Mascha, El Agoy Meshay Leidaucha, the reason why you should pour out your wrath against the nations, they don't know you. They can hardly say they were doing your work. They don't recognize you. And therefore, we can safely say the Egyptians did not say L'shem Yichud before they persecuted the Jewish people. They did not have a mitzvah in mind. And confirmation of that is when Hashem says the time is to let them go, Paro says no. So clearly it's not L'shem mitzvah, it's L'shem Paro. And at that point, once their orientation and their intent is for selfish purposes, they have abdicated and forfeited any right to consideration as doing Hashem's work. And at that point, they're on their own, and they'll be punished. And here too, the Ramban adduces a pasuk, or here psukim, from later on in the Navi. This is from Sefer Yeshaya, in Perek Yud. And the pasuk says, Hoy Ashur, Shevet Api. Woe to Ashur, Assyria, the rod of my anger. This is referring to what Assyria had done to the 10 tribes. B'goy chanefa shachenu, I will punish him, because he doesn't see himself in that way. He doesn't see himself as an instrument of my wrath. Ulevava lo ken yachshov. Rather, as far as he's concerned, ki yomar, he says, hello, sarai yachdav melachim, I'm in charge, I can do what I want. And therefore, we see the Novi Yeshaya is saying, woe to the king of Ashur. He really is an instrument of my wrath against those 10 tribes. He doesn't recognize that, and that's why he will get his retribution. So this then is the second explanation. It's a matter of kavana. And interestingly, this idea is echoed by Rabbi Yitzchak Berditchev in the Kedushas Levi, and it's something that receives expression in the daily tefillas, in Psukei Dezimra, where we say, as towards the end of Psukei Dezimra, as we start to move towards Yetzias Mitzrayim and Az Yashir, and in the prelude to that, we quote Psukim, where we say, Atitin Osos Amosim Faro, etc. You put signs and you punish Paro. Why? Ki yodato ki hezidu aleihem. Because you knew, ki hezidu aleihem. Mezid is criminal intent. And that's something that Hashem, once again, Don Anochi, judges at the time. When the time comes to let the Jewish people go free, then the Egyptians will be surveyed. What was their intent? Their intent was for my purposes? No. Ki hezidu aleihem. That is the explanation, because their intent was nefarious in nature and self-serving and godless, ultimately. So they cannot claim to be doing God's work when they're actually doing their best to counter all of his designs. So these are the two classic answers of the Ramban. Again, basic themes within the Makos, the punishment of the Egyptians, things that we take for granted, but really do need to be considered and confronted. And to continue in this vein, let us go back to the first three, the first nine Makos, which, as we say, are punitive in nature. But we will discover another element within them, as which goes together with the punishment. And this begins with the famous acronyms of Rebbe Yehuda, as we list them out by name from 1 to 10, and then we say, Rebbe Yehuda hayanosim em simonim. Rebbe Yehuda, he would give signs and acronyms, mnemonics for them. Tzach adash be'achav. He condensed these into 10 letters, which then become 3 words. I remember my father, Zatzal, once remarked to me, Rebbe Yehuda is referred to in the end of Maseches Brachos as Rosh HaMedabri B'chol Mokom. He was the one that would always speak first. He was a very popular speaker. People loved to hear from him. And the reason why, said my father, is that people like someone who's brief. If you can take 10 words and reduce them to 10 letters, you have an audience. Rosh HaMedabri B'chol Mokom. But what is the meaning behind reducing them to these 10 letters? And specifically then they become grouped with 3 groups, 3, 3, and then 4. Do these groups have something in common with each other? And indeed they do. As many Meforshim point out, these 3 sets of 3 reflect Hashem's power, number 1, on the terranean level, that is to say, the earth itself and the water itself, Dam, Tzvardeya. That's the first 3, Dam, Tzvardeya, and Kinim, the water and the earth, which is basic surface level. And then the second set, you have the sphere above that, animals that are walking upon them as Arov and as Dever, and people affected by boils. And then the third set is really from the upper realms. Things are raining down, whether it's the hail or whether it's the locust or whether it's light that is not being allowed to, which is being blocked out from higher realms. So these then are the 3 realms of existence in this world that were the stage for these 3 sets of makos. And the reason why this is so significant is because, in a sense, you have to start again each time, because the pagan conception was that there are multiple deities, which means that each realm will have its own deity. So the big chiddush that Moshe is unleashing upon Paro and Egypt, and by extension on the world, is that Hashem is the deity, and it's not restricted to any one realm. So it's specifically showing Hashem acting in all of these realms that introduces the idea that Hashem is not in any way restricted, not his area of power or of control. But because that's true, so then every time a new set begins, whether it's the first 3 or the second 3 or the third 3, the process needs to begin again. Because from a certain point of view, Paro will say, okay, so you've established that he is a god on the terrain level, but what does that say about anything else? So it needs to be introduced and presented to Paro. And this, says Reb Leib Mintzberg in the Ben Melech, is what's behind the well-known idea that there exists an internal circuitry within each of the 3, whereby the first 2 plagues, there is a warning for them. But then the third in each set of 3, there is no warning. So for example, for Dam and Tzvardeya, numbers 1 and 2, Paro is warned. For Kinim, it just happens. There is no warning. And number 1, then back again. For numbers 4 and 5, Arov and Dever, there's a warning. And Shchin, no. And finally, for Barad, Arbe, yes. And then Choshech, no. Makas Bechoris, as we said, is an entity to itself. It's attached as number 10. but why is this so? What is behind this well-known idea that for each set of 3, the first 2 come with a warning and the third doesn't? And the way Reb Mintzberg explains it is that part of what needs to be established through the punishments is that this is really Hashem's control. If something unusual happens, so one might be inclined to ascribe it to any freak incident or occurrence or forces or whatever it will be. often people relate to something strange as like an anomaly and not representative necessarily of anything. And that can happen once or twice. By the third time, a pattern is established. At that point, it becomes pretty clear something else is going on entirely. And this remains true in many, many areas, whereby if something happens once or twice, lahavdil, in the area of halacha, if an ox gores once or twice, we don't know if it's violent. If it gores three times, now you know. The first two could be ascribed to extraneous circumstances or some other thing that's going on, not necessarily indicative of the nature of the ox. But once it's happened three times, you stop looking at these things as isolated anomalies and you begin to see them as part of a pattern. Which means, within each of the three realms, the first two times, it's important for Moshe to predict it, because that needs to establish that when it happens, it's because of what Moshe is saying. Otherwise, you might just ascribe it to a freak occurrence. That may be true for the first time or the second time. But by the third time, because it's the third time, you don't need a warning. You don't need Moshe to say in Hashem's name that it will happen in order to recognize that it's from Hashem, because this is already the third time in each of these spheres. At that point, it's clear. And even the Chartumim, or the Pharaoh's magicians, the very first time this happened, they're looking to replicate the first Makkah and the second Makkah, but by the time the third one comes along, they say, it's enough. This is the third time. These are not things that we have any parity with. Etz Belokimhi, says Rav Mintzberg, isn't because there's something about the third that wasn't true of the first two, but rather it's because it's the third. A pattern's been established. These are not freak occurrences, and we can't contend with it. And it's not because they were holding in Cheskas Abatim that they have this idea. It's a basic truth that at a certain point you look at things differently if they keep on happening. And that is what's behind the lack of warning. The warning is there to establish and secure. It should be clear that this is coming from Hashem. You were told about it beforehand. For the first two times in each sphere, you need that. For the third time, you don't need that. Chazaka will do it by itself. But what emerges from all of the above discussions is that we need to appreciate that the punishment of the Egyptians, which is such a significant part of the whole of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and certainly of our Parsha and the next, it's part of the building of the Jewish people. Everything that happens in Mitzrayim is to produce the Jewish people, to create them and to develop them. As we spoke about last week, it's the Kor HaBarzel, including what they witnessed with the punishment of the Egyptians. And that's why the Hashem's control over everything, which was the medium through which he established that through punishing the Egyptians, needs to be absorbed by the Jewish people. That consciousness, they need to take that with them as part of Hashem's people. They witnessed it in Mitzrayim. It's part of their relationship with Hashem, that awareness of his control over everything. And also their awareness of the idea of Schar Va'onesh, which the Egyptians foot the bill for because they were so persecuted the Jewish people in that way. And that for everything that the Jewish people see happening to the Egyptians is a lesson for them. And it's part of, it's to take within their national consciousness and their national profile as they approach Har Sinai to initiate their relationship with Hashem through the giving of the Torah. They already have set in their makeup an awareness of Hashem as controller of the world through the Makkos in Mitzrayim. Hashem as someone who deals measure for measure, Schar Va'onesh, through what they saw in Mitzrayim. They also see how beloved the Jewish people are, because of what Hashem did in order to give retribution for those that had persecuted his people. That's also part of the relationship with Hashem, to be aware of that chavibus of the Jewish people. So these are things that began there. And as Reb Shlomo Kluger says, when we say in Pirkei Avos, Asara nisim na'asu la'avoseinu b'mitzrayim, 10 miracles happened to our forefathers in Egypt. The miracles is the fact that they were saved from the Makkos, say the Mefarshim. Those were the 10 miracles. The Egyptians were afflicted with 10 Makkos, and we were saved from them. Those are the 10 Nisim. But each Makkah that we're spared from taught us a lesson. When you teach someone a lesson, you become their father. Whoever teaches someone Torah, It's like they're their son. So it says, Shlomer Kluger, Asara Nisim Nasul Avosenu Bimitzrayim. Do not translate 10 miracles happened or performed for our fathers. 10 miracles became our fathers. Asara Nisim Nasul Avosenu Bimitzrayim. How did they become our fathers? Because they became our teachers. What did they teach us? About Hashem. His control over the world, Mida Keneged Mida, punishment, Scharva Onesh, beloved nature of the Jewish people. That's a lot of lessons to learn from the Makkos. The Makkos become your father now in that regard. So these are lessons that we learned, lessons that we've kept with us, and these are lessons that we keep with us because we're currently in a stage where things are pending full redemption. But what was instilled with us at our core at Yetzias Mitzrayim are things that we are expecting and anticipating to see. Ki meitzei seinu mi eretz Mitzrayim yarenu neflos. Everything that we experience in Mitzrayim, we should experience again and more as we head towards the geula shalema, which should come b'mehirah b'yamim.